Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about how to make pre-gen characters for one-shot D&D games. How to do it fast, how to do it easy, and in a way that sets up for a great story. All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Now, Dan, we're also going to be talking about other types of RPGs, given that the convention season is coming and we're doing a lot of prep these days. But before we get into it, I want to remind everyone that, as always, at the end of the show, we'll be hosting our after-party chat. So if you'd like to discuss the topic more in person with us, we will be hosting a video chat on our Discord server, and you can join in by becoming a patron. Visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, join at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our private Discord server. And that Discord server is where we'll be hosting the video chat right around a little after 2, maybe 2:10, 2:15 p.m. Eastern today.
We have the best patrons, and we love getting an opportunity to chat to them. For example, thanks to our patron, Vacuous, for checking that all of our channels are live today with the correct links and things like that. So thanks for finding us here live on Sunday. We appreciate it.
Yeah, for sure. So Dan, this came
week,
up
I'm glad
for us.
We've got things set up in advance properly.
Yeah, definitely. So this came up for us, Dan. Viewers may remember a couple of weeks ago, we talked about our co-DM'd game that we ran for a friend of ours. And then in the lead up to that game, there was a lot of discussion amongst the players whether we would be creating characters or giving pre-gens. And ultimately, because no, normally what I would say is in a convention game or any kind of like 4-hour one shot, I would say absolutely not to character creation. No way you're getting pre-gens, end of story. Now, in this case, we knew we had a little bit more time, a little bit more leeway. And so we kind of made it their option of, do you want pre-gens? Or if you want, we can custom craft characters, especially since the birthday boy was completely surprised by the game. And so didn't really have a voice in that conversation until the moment of. And then ultimately, they all decided that they wanted pre-gens, which was very interesting. So I wanted to talk about that. And then also, like I said, I'm now preparing for the upcoming convention season. Like starting in November, I'm probably hitting about a convention a month, which is crazy. So I'm doing a lot of prep work for that and making characters, and especially making characters for horror games and Fearful Ends, which I find to be actually radically different from making D&D pre-gens. And so I thought, let's talk about it.
Now that's interesting, because I'll admit that most of my work goes into classic D&D. So I was making pre-gens that were available. We didn't actually use them, but were available in that birthday game a couple weeks ago. So I too was thinking about my process and how I developed those, and actually tweaking a couple things in my tool that's on GitHub as a result of that. So I agree. This is very, very much on very fresh to me, and I thought it was a good idea. And I agree, Paul. The very first thing is use pre-gens. And I will.
Yeah.
I've said it a couple of times, but when I first got into original D&D and was doing some convention tournament type stuff, I made the mistake of thinking, "Oh, it's so cursory. It's so short. Of course, we're going to get the whole flavor of classic D&D of making characters on the fly." And, you know, as a bit of an expert, it's easy to overlook how many questions players might have. Why should I pick this class instead of another one? Why should I emphasize this ability versus another one? Why should I pick this piece of equipment or the spell? And it can go on much longer than an expert player expects. So I ran into that quagmire a couple times, corrected course, and I'm very much in agreement that for a one shot, pre-gens solve all kinds of problems, get the play started sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. You'll remember actually back on my birthday, I ran a D&D game where I did let the players make their own characters. And I tried every trick I know of to speed that up. But you're right, like sort of like the higher level that you're starting at, the more options there are for players to be picking from, and they will hem and haw over every little decision, right? Yes, you can generate stats real fast, and you can probably pick your race and class real fast. And then you get into spell selection and inventory selection, and maybe you got to generate some magic items if they're higher level, and that whole thing just becomes real slow. In that game, it's worth mentioning just a couple the tricks that I used in that game. Right, is I had some pre-generated equipment lists that were just thematic. Right, so I had like two thief equipment lists, one that was for a burglar and one that was for an assassin. Right, stuff like that. So I said, like, you can go through the equipment list if you want, or like, here's a package, you could just take it, right? And there was a couple options there. Try to minimize the choices so that they can really hone in. You could do similar with spells. And then with magic items, I think what I did is I said, I gave everyone a plus one something. I think we were playing like fourth level, so it felt like to have two-ish magic items felt right. So I said, everyone just gets a plus one something, whatever they want. And then here's a list of 10 weird magic items. You can pick one from the list, and once you pick it, it's gone. And that was kind of fun, right? It kind of gave players that option to, you know, talk about those 10 magic items I had given them access to and what would be good to take or whatnot. But still, ultimately, right, there was a conversation had. People hemmed and hawed over which one to pick, right? Mm-hmm. It slows things down. And when you only have 4 hours to run a game, like, it's just not worth it. I think it's just not worth it.
So part of the question for me in this chat is, like, how close can we get to playing immediately? There's going to have to be a little bit of selection, just like what character you took. But there are a bunch of stuff that you and I, Paul, still overlook potentially and still run into these conversations. And it won't be perfect, but I'm wondering how close we can get to just sitting down and immediately playing as soon as possible.
Yep. Now, let's talk a little bit. Now, you mentioned that you have software for this. And the funny thing is, I have software for this too. And I totally forgot when setting up the event to put links to those two things in the YouTube description. So hopefully Dan will remember at the end of this to update that and get those links out there.
Well, Paul, once again, see, this is why there's two brain tiers, because I've already done that. So viewers, if you go to the YouTube description right now, you can see links to both Paul's online tool as well as my Java-based tool. And they are, in fact, there right the second.
Thank you for anticipating me, Dan. You're right. This is why there's two of us. That's amazing. Okay, fantastic. So let's talk about the characters we used for the game just 2 weeks ago. Was it 2 weeks ago? Well, however long ago that was. Those were generated using my online OD&D character generator, which is also, I've also used for BX. And as I look back at the code, I can see all the little tweaks and changes I've made to it over the years. And eventually adapting it for OED. But there's definitely, you know, the funny thing is there's some BX-isms in the code that I didn't realize.
This is kind of the summer of BX conversation. So I guess a month ago I might have been surprised about that, but now I'm not, Paul.
So my and I'll be curious actually to compare how our code differs here. So in my case, usually when I'm generating characters, I know at least like the number of characters in the level range, right? So we know that we want like level 5 to 7 for this adventure, and we knew we were going to have like 6-ish players. The first thing I'll say is when I'm running D&D one shots, I try to make about double the number of characters necessary. Both so that the players have options, right? So that they still get some choice, right? When they're sitting down, which character do I want to play? And then also because I assume the game is going to be very deadly. And if someone dies in the first hour or two, I want an option for them to be able to go back to the pile and pick a new character and come back in and keep playing.
Agreed. And you know, that tends to be, I think based on our experience, that tends to be a little bit more true at lower levels, right? And so higher level D&D characters tend to be a little bit more robust, a little bit more chances to take some thumps and then recover. But certainly if you're playing first level characters, they're very squishy. I totally agree. I would have said the exact same thing of have about as twice as many as the players you expect for exactly that reason.
Yeah, no, in this game, it was level 5 to 7, I think, and still we had one. I know we had at least one player who had to go back to the table and pick a new character. Yeah. So it happens.
You might have had to do it twice, too. I think they either had to do it twice or they were close to doing it twice.
Yeah, I think so.
I almost got two of them.
I think they were I think they were close to it, but the other one of them managed to hang in there. So usually the way I start with generating, and I'm looking at my code here, right? So I'm looking at my code here to talk about, and I'm kind of curious what your entry point is, Dan. But my code, usually what I just simply start with is, great, I want 12 characters, and I know I want, and what I start with is a specific amount of XP. They all should have exactly this much XP. And I usually am very careful with that, of crafting that number, because there's some very nice numbers where things will happen, like, in our level 5 to 7 game, we ended up with level 7 thieves, and single class magic users have just enough XP to hit 5th level so that they'll have access to those 3rd level spells, whereas multi-class characters will not have enough XP and they'll end up being a 2nd level caster at best.
Agreed.
It's a nice spread there. I think I want to think that that number is like 18 or 20,000 K, something like that. I don't have it in front of me, so I don't remember.
I think there's,
I spent some time thinking about those numbers.
You're right. Most of the, in classic D&D, most of the time, at least in the mid levels, if you pick a random number, it's usually fighters, magic users, and clerics are all at level N, and the thieves are at N plus one. There's exceptions. It's not perfectly regular, of course. And in fact, in original D&D, there's a place where wizards start outpacing fighters for a brief moment. But yeah, most of the time, if you pick a random number, you'll get most of the characters at one level and thieves one level higher, which is why those XP tables have that gradient.
Dan, I'm gonna stop myself from digging into more details here real quick to take a question from the chat. So Funks asks, do you name your pregens or let your players do that? And I will say, in my case, what's ended up happening over the years is I ended up just making a standard battery of 12 characters, and I now have them at multiple level ranges. So I used to use this generator all the time, but now I just, like, I have these 12 characters at different level ranges, and I just bring them. And they all have names. They have pre-existing names. And I will actually stand by that choice. If a player was, like, really, like, wanted to rename their character, I would let them.
Yep.
But
yep.
I would say probably about 50% of the players at the table will pick the character solely based on the name.
Oh, great. Okay, great observation.
Now I've got an interesting, amusing names, right? My characters have names like Bungo the Drunk and Majid of the Seven Shadows, right? They have evocative names that players get excited about. And they're like, yep, I want to play Bungo the Drunk, the halfling fighter. Perfect.
So great. So I agree with Paul on this, and I do the same thing. I also have a stock library of characters of different levels, and I also have them named. And I will say that my generator tool creates names automatically. I think yours does too, Paul, mm-hmm. right?
Yep. And are they based on the same? They're probably based on the same original data of that name generator that we both love.
Paul, actually. At a later date, I went, did a little research and grabbed larger libraries of historical names. And generally speaking, for me now, I think that, like, the human characters get classically German names, and the dwarf characters get Dutch, and the elf get Finnish or something like
Interesting.
So it's a little bit more subtle, but it has a very large body of data built into what I call my arena tool now. And I'll say that one of the themes here is that by using pre-generated characters, including the names, you can cheat. Just the DM can cheat a little bit by inserting campaign themes, right? By theming things mm-hmm. for the campaign. Instead of letting the if you let the players name them, they're probably not aware of the campaign world. They don't know what the themes are. They're a little bit at sea, and they're going to come up with some stuff that's silly, right? We've all seen this of like Mickey Mouse, right? Or I named my character Paul Siegel. Isn't that funny? Ha ha! My character's Paul Siegel. And so by stepping in there and thinking about by injecting the names there, that gives you the flavor of what the game is supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And it gives a little bit more control and a little bit more communication from the DM. So it's one of the ways that using pre-gens can help you out there. It's an interesting point, Paul, that frankly, if you're talking about like how much backstory do you need, Bongo the Drunk is enough. Like just like the name and a simple case is actually enough to get a player excited and fill in a hole. Yep. Here's the personality that I'm bringing to the table. Yep. It can be as much as just two words like that.
Yeah. And in fact, I'll point out, I've got a few character names in there that feel like they kind of ping off of each other. For example, Bungo the Drunk is one of them because there's another character in the pile named Godric the Wine Merchant. And I can't tell you how many players have picked those two characters specifically assuming a pre-existing relationship. Right? And it's just delightful. And it's based solely on their names. That's it. That's all they have to go on. Just the name. I just know this Godric the Wine Merchant, Bungo the Drunk, clearly these two adventure together for a reason.
See, that's that is pure gold for classic. And that is how little you need to get to really get started with something really wonderful. That is really excellent advice.
So, Dan, let me ask you, I mean, we could get into the nitty gritty details of like stat generation and whatnot, but I don't think that's terribly interesting. I think what's really interesting here is some of the weird questions that come up in the course of play. So the other thing that I feel like I get asked all the time, especially when there are pre-gens on the table, is do our characters know each other? Should I assume that we've been adventuring together for a while, or have we just met? What's your take on that question?
Okay, I think my knee-jerk reaction is if you have, and we were playing with slightly higher level characters most recently, if you have characters of slightly higher levels, I generally want to say, yes, you have been adventuring before, you know each other, feel free to share your abilities and your spells and your magic items so that, assuming I'm running kind of a tough game, so that you come into the encounters at full capacity. And not be, you know, stumbling around because I don't know who you are and what you do. And so, yeah, I tend to say if it's first level, then maybe not. But if it's higher level and we're going to have these discussions of abilities and stuff like that, I say assume awareness of your capacities.
Yeah. Yeah. I do the same thing for specifically for my D&D games. And in fact, for this specific batch of 12 characters that I use, where I will tell the players, well, this group of 12 characters are part of a large mercenary band. And they fracture and they move around the countryside. And so sometimes a smaller group of them is doing something, but they're not surprised to see one of the other ones show up. And that also then excuses the, like, a player dies and another one shows up. And they go, oh, you finally caught up, you know. Oh, Godric the Wine Merchant's finally here. I've been waiting. My wine flask is almost empty. So I like that.
I hadn't seen you do that before, Paul, and I thought that worked so well in the game that we just played. That is a great that is a great way to handle it.
Yeah. Now this is an area where what I do for D&D is actually radically different from what I do for horror. Is that interesting to dig in now?
How does that differ?
Yeah. So, generally, my horror games, I'm usually running for 2 to 6 or 3 to 6 players is kind of the range I'm looking at. I've never really run for 2. It's usually 3 to 6. But anyway, and with those characters, the interesting thing about those characters and I've done this for the adventures I've written, and I've realized this is now also my process for running other pre-written material. And this is why I was thinking about this stuff earlier, was, you know, like I said, I'm about to run a bunch of games at conventions. I'll be running a bunch of Fearful Ends games. In addition to my own stuff, I'm running some Call of Cthulhu adventures that I have adapted to Fearful Ends. And those adventures typically do not come with characters. And that's something I actually find I really like in my horror games is to have characters who have some kind of pre-existing relationship with a little tension in there. I like the players to begin the game at the start of horror with some things that they're trying to resolve amongst each other that are completely ordinary. It's really nice because what I find is then as the horror elements get rolled in and terrible things happen and the mental stress cards come out and they start reacting badly, those give them the little hooks that they can then explode into the ridiculous, right? Does that make sense? So you might have two characters who are, you know, or maybe you have three characters who are in a love triangle, right? And that's amusing and interesting at the beginning of the game, and by the end of the game, it is intense drama. Because now our characters have become unhinged, and they're dealing with life and death situations, and by the way, there's a love triangle, right? And so they'll end up hooking into stuff that happened earlier in the game to flesh out the details of their mental collapse, which I really, really enjoy. So generally what I'm doing, what I spend the most time with for my Fearful Ends characters, yes, I give them stats and I come up with, you know, names and the perks is an interesting thing to come up with. But I also do write a couple paragraphs of their backstory, which is something I would never do for D&D. Right? But I give each character a couple paragraphs for the players to read at the very beginning that says, here's the little info, little background about your character, about their life up until this point of this adventure. And I've started implementing what I call the 3-2-1 system for these characters, which is I generate three who are in some kind of pre-existing three, you know, triangle-y relationship.
Okay.
Create two characters who were related to each other or have some pre-existing relationship, and one solo character. And the reason for that is that gives me then the combination, so based on the number of players that are sitting down at my table, I know exactly which characters to remove from the game.
I follow. Yeah. So if you have three, you get the triangle. If you have four, you get the triangle plus the one. If you have five, you get the three and the two. I follow. That's great.
Yep, exactly right.
Right. Great.
Yep. Yeah, it's nice because I've definitely been in horror games where I like sit there and go, oh no, I've only got five instead of six people at my table. Which one of these characters is the least important? Who do I remove? So having them in that 3-2-1 format, I just know. Oh, nope, this character's out. Great.
I mean, six is a wonderful number because it's the lowest common multiple of 1, 2, and 3. We all know that.
There you go. There you go.
So that's very interesting. And I'm wondering, and it also makes sense to me, I think, with a horror game where part of the play is restricted information, being unaware, scary mysteries around the corners. Mm-hmm. So a reduction of information makes a lot of sense there. And therefore, you have to spend a little bit more time detailing exactly who does know who. Because you're not in a situation where we're going to come in and say, just assume awareness between all of you and there's no secrets. What comes first in that case? Do you write the backstories first and then stat things out? Or do you get stats first and then use that as inspiration for the backstories?
It's a little back and forth, honestly. I know. I feel like I would have been more challenged by this question 2 weeks ago. But like I literally just went through this. So here's what I did. Is I came up with like the very high level arc of the 3-2-1, and I wrote down myself just quick bullet points of like, here's a general idea of this character, right? In this particular game, because it's Classic Cthulhu, it's in Massachusetts in the 20s. So I was like, okay, I got these three characters in this setting, these two, and I know the setting of the adventure, right? In this case, I know the setting of the scenario. So I'm like, so I write these very high level bullets, then I stat them out. And then once they're statted out, then I sit down and write the long form couple of paragraphs. Now I know a lot more about
them. Okay, got it. Got it.
Of course, statting people out in Fearful Ends is radically different from D&D, right? When I look at my pre-gens for D&D, rolling the stats and picking the race and class and like figuring out levels based on XP is really just so much math, frankly. I was looking at my code that I wrote to do this, and it's, you know, the algorithms are very straightforward. Where it gets interesting is picking spells and equipment. That's where it suddenly starts to become interesting, I think, for D&D characters and where they become really different. With Fearful Ends, you know, it's pretty quick for me to give them attributes and skills. I think of like broad strokes. Okay, this guy's a bus driver, so he's going to have, I don't know, higher agility and maybe lower intellect. Something, right? Boom, boom, boom. It goes pretty quick, right? He should have skills.
I'm taking all the bus drivers watching. Sorry.
Yeah. So I mean, that stuff's fairly easy, right? Right. And then I'm like, usually in the case of like a horror game, I'm like, I want at least two of the six characters to reasonably understand how to shoot a gun because it's fun for firearms to show up and be inconvenient and unpleasant. right. Seagull, so stat those out. Rip. And then, sorry, where was I going with this? Right. So with the Fearful Ends characters, the interesting stat part is the perks. Perks, I find, are what really set those characters apart. Skill selection is kind of interesting, but the perks get down to like, okay, well, what kind of perk does a 1920s era bus driver have? I don't know, right? Then I start coming up with weird stuff. Well, I gave him a high strength because he was the only character that it made sense to be kind of strong. So maybe he was an athlete prior to becoming a bus driver. Maybe he's an ex-boxer. Okay, great. That's a perk. You know, former heavyweight champion of Arkham, Massachusetts. Great.
Nice. Nice.
Yeah.
Can I make a quick aside here, Paul, that you are mm-hmm. in Massachusetts in the 20s?
It's true. It is quite true. Different 20s. Different 20s. But yeah, 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 yeah.
So
it's funny, you know, last week, this is such a ridiculous aside, but last week you were talking about how, or maybe 2 weeks ago, you were talking about how you like how coming up with rulings for D&D based on like the real world gives you a better understanding of the world. For me, creating characters for a horror game sends me down the strangest research rabbit holes where I learn a lot about history. Like this bus driver thing, I'm bringing this up not because like it's random. Okay. This is literally, I made this character. He's a bus driver and an ex-boxer. And I had to ask myself the question, wait, were there buses in the 1920s? Was that a thing? And then I went down this whole rabbit hole of what the progression of public transport was in the United States. It's fascinating. And now I know way more about that than I need to know. But there you go.
I think this is a good thing. I think that just like Perla said in the Art of Wargaming, you know, games are fundamentally about communication. And I think that for me, this is a major component of gaming that I would hate to lose. I'm glad to have a friend that knows a lot about public transportation in the 1920s, Paul.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I learned the word bustitution, which is jamming together substitution and buses, because this happened in the United States. All the streetcars got replaced with buses at one point when streetcars started to fall out of vogue.
Okay, I thought it was bus and something else.
But nope, substitution.
Okay. Got it. Good to know. Glad that was clarified. Very good.
Prostitution. And I think my read of it is that I think people at the time weren't terribly pleased with it, that this was a downgrade. And people were like, public transport just got shittier.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Which I think is great. Very interesting. Anyway.
Fascinating.
So.
Total non sequitur. I apologize for this, everybody. I'm currently reading a physics book that I inherited from my great aunt that was published 100 years ago. And I'm like about two chapters into it. And I realized, for you physics fans out there, that this predates the definition of the Newton as a unit of force. That wasn't defined until 1948, right? And I'm like, this physics book has no Newtons in the metric exercises because it hasn't been defined yet. And I had to go look, why is this happening? I had to go look up when that got defined and why and how and what the history of that was. So again, random things that us on the spectrum
it's so
enjoy right, finding right? out about. Right?
I'm right. Like, I definitely fall down these rabbit holes because I'm like, well, but why? Why were they replacing streetcars with buses? Well, because of the invention of the rubber tire, of course. I'm like, they didn't have rubber tires before the 20s? Jeez, I had no idea. Right.
Anyway. Exactly that. Exactly. I'm going to work that in my game. Absolutely.
Right. That's always the problem with this level of research. Then you're like, I've got to pull all of this information into the game, and then I'm going to be unhappy if my players don't express, you know, surprise at the amazing rubber tires of the buses and dismay that their loyal streetcars have been replaced with buses. Like, okay, this is such a minor detail. This is not actually important to the game. It's fine. My old writing professor would have called all of this. Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it's good. I think it's valuable to do. It's valuable work for the DM to do. And actually, my writing professor in college called this stuff scaffolding. She was like, and she was thinking about it in terms of like creative writing, where it was like, you will write a bunch of this stuff down and realize that it's just scaffolding to get to the actual work, and then you will take it down. This research, I think, is scaffolding to build the characters that then I'm going to rip out later and not care that's not in the game.
And I think the other way of looking at it is, I think Steve Martin's advice of, you're going to use everything someday. Everything you ever learned is going to come up someday. It might not be this adventure. It might not be this year, but someday it's going to pop up randomly in a game, and people are going to be amazed that you were able to cover that because of your knowledge of this particular context or something like that. So I kind of embrace that myself. Okay, so to rein it back, to bring it back around to, so you were talking about the interesting thing in Fearful Lens being some skills and more of the perks. And one thing that I would say in making pre-gens, and you know, for me, I'm making classic D&D specifically for our OED custom game, and we've talked about that on prior shows. Viewers, you can go to oedgames.com, and we have an entire classic retro clone that's available for free, and a lot of resources for that that we've worked on. And one thing I would say is, whatever your game system is, take the opportunity to highlight the interesting things about the game system. So for Paul with Fearful Hands, you know, throw out a variety of the perks, right? Don't just entirely randomly pick and possibly have like three of the same type. Like, cover the interesting random perks so that new players of the game get a taste for the kinds of things that are available here. And so for me with OED, I think very carefully, we have a system called Fighter Feats, which, you know, kind of comes similar to third edition D&D, but, you know, just is a way of encapsulating all the things that fighters could do in early classic D&D, like have exceptional strength or multiple attacks or possibly berserking or tracking or something like that falls under that rubric. So I one of the things that I emphasize is I want to cover a number of these feats, and I try to pick out the ones that players might find to be more interesting. So I try to pick for the fighters that have a feat that starts at fourth level, I pick the berserking feat, right? I pick exceptional strength to kind of, you know, talk about that. You know, if you like the exceptional strength from first edition, there's one character with that option. There's weapon specialization. There's one person that has rapid attack or something like that. And maybe if I can, I throw in a tracking feat to kind of suggest a ranger. So that's kind of the feature that's a little bit different about OED, maybe. And so I try to highlight that and pick out the things that are interesting. If I entirely just use my randomizer, I'm going to get duplications. I'm going to get several fighters with, frankly, maybe not particularly interesting feats. Maybe, you know, if it's a dungeon adventure, you're going to get one character with the mounted combat, which obviously isn't appropriate at all. You might have the survival feat that's for wilderness adventures, which probably isn't appropriate. So I go in, and that's probably one of the things that I'm very careful to tune, cover, and highlight what's interesting about this game system. And on the same point, I try to have coverage of the different race class combinations. So I've got human, fighter, wizard, thief. I have dwarf and halfling fighter thieves, right? Fighters and thieves. And then you have your multi-classed elf fighter wizard. And I also have an elf fighter thief in there, is what I usually do. And that comes out to about 12. So I try to cover the combinations. If people are coming in and going, oh, it's early D&D, it's races class, they get to see, oh, no, there's a dwarf fighter, or you could have a dwarf thief. That's actually what would happen in D&D. So that kind of highlights that. And it's another opportunity for the DM to cheat a little bit and kind of design the demographics to communicate what the world looks like. So half of my PCs are humans, and the other half are either dwarf, elf, or halfling. And I think you and I, Paul, it's a little bit of a cheat, because you and I, Paul, know that with classic D&D, if people come in and just pick mechanically, it's quite likely they're going to pick all elves. It's quite likely they're going to pick all demi-humans or elves or something like that. So admittedly, I'm kind of cheating just a little bit to avoid that and communicate what the world is like with the graphics of my characters. And it gives me another lever.
Advantage. I hadn't really thought of like that angle, but although I'm sure that I've done it as well, maybe subconsciously, of pushing for that, like, yes, I want the majority of them to be humans by simply having the majority of the pregens available are humans. that's a good way to do it. Let me talk a little bit about how my group of 12 came about. because it's kind of interesting. It's slightly different than what you're talking about, but also maybe it's a slightly different method of doing the exact same thing you just talked about, which is specifically, so I made my 12 characters at level 9, and then I scaled them back to different levels so that I can, like, I just imagine, like, what would they have been like at 7th level? What would they have been like at 5th level? What would they have been like at 3rd level? So that way it gives me my level spread. And frankly, what I did is I generated a lot more than 12. I can't remember how many I generated, 50 or something. And I picked the 12 most interesting. So a lot of my stuff was random, but then through having a very large pool of randomness, I was able to self-pick and get those things like, let me get two fighters with very different specializations. Let me pick, I have two pure single class wizards in it, because that's always important, I think, for me, of like, I want there, you know, whatever the level is, I want there to be two choices for somebody who's just been all out wizard and so has access to like really cool spells and magic. And I made them, I picked two that are very different. One is very much like into like all the combat-y, you know, fireballs and lightning bolts and magic missiles and such. And another one who's much more utility based, of like, I have all of your levitates and invisibilities and all that stuff. And it comes through in the magic items too. And that's, I think that in, when I look at my code for character generation, I think it's the algorithm for picking magic items that I think is the most interesting and unusual. And so I'm kind of curious to pick your brain, Dan, on what you do for this, because it's also something that I say then when I'm handing out, I'm like, here are the pre-gens. And I, one of the things I always tell my players is, hey, definitely look at their equipment, because there's some interesting magic items in there. And it's definitely true. There are, you know, I've in my group of 12, assuming they're not like first level versions, right? If they're at least, I think, 4th level, two of them have intelligent swords. One, you know, a couple of them are carrying permanent flying magic items, right? I've got a broom of flying and a flying carpet in there. So there's, you know, and it really can shape how the players tackle an adventure based on picking for magic items.
Interesting. Now, I do have a different take on this, frankly. And partly, you know, my software tool started out for NPC. So I have a tool called NPC Generator that will spit out OED style stuff. And initially it was just like two lines of text. And then I added, and it can spit out a whole PDF character sheet based on that same character. So that's my basis for my PC creation. And then I tweak it and tune it and add to it manually once I get it. So for me, I actually emphasized, partly by having it rooted for NPCs, is that at the table, for me, and I think this is okay for player, for like new player perspective, is I actually mostly wanted to avoid exotic, crazy stuff that I would have to look up in the book. So actually, and not everybody is gonna approve of this, but the majority of what I do is just simple plus one bonuses to a weapon or a piece of gear, and maybe a ring of protection, which is a plus bonus, and then maybe a potion, and for your magic users, maybe a wanderer staff, right? Which is hopefully tied in mostly to a known spell. So I actually try to keep stuff fairly knowable on sight, right? I try not to have a whole lot of conversations about drums of panic. What are these? And then I have to go look that up. Like, what's the exact mechanic to a mirror of life trapping or something like that? So
I mean, this is my argument for using a consistent group, right? This is why I like having a consistent group of 12, because I know them and I know their magic items. Yes, some of the magic items are wacky, but they're the same ones, right? Every time I run a convention D&D game, it's the same magic items coming up. And I have removed truly weird stuff like the Drums of Panic. I love that you pick on that one, because I was just like, every time I see that show up on a character, I'm like, oh, Drums of Panic, are you kidding me? What? And is that ever going to be useful? Right, that's the other thing is, I want the list of magic items they have to be generally useful, but not crafted to the specific adventure, right? I don't want anyone being like, oh, the key to beating this adventure was to have brought this character who has this magic item that was clearly put in there to solve this problem in the adventure. Yeah. Definitely not, right? I make that clear. I'm like, this is the same group of characters I always use. some of their magic items will be useful, some will not be. And it will be different from adventure to adventure, just like in a real campaign.
I notice that you're careful to say that when you start out one of those games. I think that's very smart to be aware of, to clarify to the players that there isn't a magic key on one of these sheets that's going to unlock a magic door. I mean, there might be, but there isn't specific one thing for one thing.
Yeah,
I think that's a good point.
I'm chuckling because quick call out to Steve Wubba Wubba. Yes, that's that. Like, Wand of Wonder is a great way to just completely upend your campaign. There are no Wand of Wonders in my pre-generated characters.
Okay,
but
okay.
I will say, like, if you look at I'm going to pick on the two top level magic users in my group of pre-gens. One of them, who's more combat oriented, got a wand of fireballs, right? And I think some other stuff that's just like pure like magic item to do damage. The other one is carting around a large collection of scrolls. And what's on those scrolls, I vary based on what level they are, and they're usually a couple of spells that would normally be out of the reach of that level character. So he's got access to a couple like powerful one-off magics that are weird and different.
Nice. Nice. Now, I think, Paul, when we were prepping for our most recent game, we you and I, part of the conversation, we came to the observation, for me, one of the key things that I'm going to give for my wizard character is maybe a wand. Basic wand out of original D&D. It could be wand of fireballs, could be wand of lightning bolts, something like that. Remember, kids, wand of magic missiles doesn't exist at that point. But what's the right, for a one-shot game, what's a good number of charges for a wand, Paul?
Six. we had this conversation because we had this conversation because often it's not written on my character sheets, and so when I'm at a convention, usually my answer is, "Well, roll a d10, roll a d10," and I've realized like actually it's not great because it totally happened in this last one. He rolled a d10 and he got a one. Now I gave him a reroll because it was the birthday boy, and I was like, "Thank God I had that excuse to give it." But the answer, I think, is ultimately, I want the number to be more than one, but I would like the number to be low enough that it's conceivable they'll run out in this adventure.
Exactly. Exactly. There has to be a little bit of tension around that. And I totally agree. And I'll say, Paul, when we were co-DMing that game and it came up one, there was like a whole drama that happened inside my body. Between him rolling the die, you making the call, I'm like, one, like, oh no, Paul, come up with a reason to change that or something. And you're like, re-roll it. I'm like, please re-roll a much higher number. And it comes up nine. You're like, that's going to be it. I'm like, great, great.
Yeah.
So good choices all around. But it's an interesting observation that I didn't really see the risk of possibly rolling the one there. But yeah, something like, you know, I could see five or six or seven. Seven's a magic number too.
Yeah, yeah. I don't hate the idea of dice being involved. So there's some great ideas going by in the chat, and you know, 2d6, 3d4, something that's going to give you that nice like bell curve. I'm down for that. Maybe d6 plus two. I might say d6 plus two. That gives me a good 3 to 9. I love it.
I could live with 2d6. You know, I could live with 2d6 myself.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I feel like two is still disappointing. I want three. I want three as my base. Three is a magic number, right? Anyway.
I've been told that.
So, anyway.
I do want to pull up a question, if I can. A really good question from, because you asked me this, Paul, actually, when we were prepping. So a couple minutes ago, our friend Disparal asked, do you play where wizards know every standard spell automatically, or do you need to assign spells as well? So I've gone through a whole evolution on this, Disparal. And of course, in our OED rules, what I have, thinking about campaign play mostly, is that wizards start out with all 10 first level spells, and then everything else you have to find is what I have. And again, the intent there was just to remove a creation issue, give your starting wizards at least a variety of choices that they can pick from there. But there was a while where for my pre-gens, I was making a full spell book of an appropriate, what I felt was an appropriate number, kind of based on the intelligence chart that you see in original D&D Supplement 1. And then you'd sit down and the player would have the capacity to pick their spell loadout when they go in the dungeon. And they could either use the cards that we have or they could just circle on the sheet. I'm memorizing this, 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 and this. But then the discovery is, in order for the player to make that decision intelligently, they might be a brand new player to D&D, they might be a brand new player to original D&D, or they might be dealing with some of the tweaks that we've made in OED to some of the spells to kind of refine stuff, is that to make those decisions intelligently, they actually need to know what all of those spells do. So that becomes a rather extended period of time of flipping through our custom book, read it, if there's any of them that's changed at all, reading basically every single spell in order to feel comfortable about their decisions. So kind of recently, my pre-gen PCs just have the spells that they've memorized. That's it. And therefore, again, that becomes a turnkey solution to, I'm trying to remove as many decisions as I can from the pre-gen play. So now my characters do actually have, here's the spells that you memorize on a regular daily basis. Let's get started. And then if the player has some questions about them, they can read the book as we go on, as we play. While other things are happening, they're reading the book, and that works a lot better than them having to preload all those decisions. So that's actually what I do nowadays, fairly recently, actually.
I mean, I get, and I certainly empathize with the desire to, like, speed things up, right? And I get that, and definitely I've seen the downside. I've seen people delaying or slowing down the progress of the game because they're like, I haven't picked my spells yet. Or worse yet, like, they seem very confident when they pick the character, and then as we get into play, I realize that they don't actually understand how memorization works. And I have to go, wait, you can't just cast every spell. Let me explain to you how this works. Yeah. So that's unfortunate. But that said, also, I'm not a fan of just saying these are your spells memorized for a couple of reasons. The biggest one, I suppose, is just like, I feel like that's why people pick wizards. Like, it's the pro class, right? I pick wizard because of their adaptability and flexibility and the ability, you know, I can pick a spell loadout based on what kind of situation I'm in. And I think it would be especially important for something that's not a one single, like, one day dungeon or one day adventure, something like the adventure we just ran, where it's an overland and there might be on traveling the wilderness for multiple days and maybe want to change up their spells based on the situation they're going into.
It feels more like
a campaign to me.
Yeah. I see. I will confess, probably my thinking was more focused on a one day dungeon type adventure. So you might have a good point there.
Let me tell you about how I sign spells, because I was surprised, honestly, actually, when I opened up the code in preparation for today's talk and looked at it. Let me talk first what I do for campaigns, frankly, is I make my magic users collect spells. I think that's part of the fun of a campaign. Playing a wizard in a campaign is you're always on the lookout for scrolls or spell books to take or whatnot. So if you're starting at first level, and what I generally do is anytime you're encountering a new spell that you're trying to transcribe into your spell book, you have to roll for it. And it's basically a check of, I think, D20 plus your level minus the level of the spell, greater or equal to 20, something like that. Something like that, right? So it's a little harder to learn higher level spells. And for any given spell, you get one check per level. And if you failed this level, well, sorry, you're not going to be able to learn that specific spell until you level up again. And so what I do for brand new first level characters is I say, here's the list of 10 first level spells. Roll for all of them, please. And it's possible a very high intelligence character or a very lucky character will end up with all 10 spells, but usually not. Usually they have some subset, which is what I like. And then over the course of play, they'll collect spells and try to get them into their book. And I like that. I like wizards having slightly different spell books from each other so that they feel like there's you know, that we're not all stamped out of the same wizard factory. I was expecting to see that basically 100% emulated in my code. And the answer is my code 100% cheats. And all it does is say it takes the number of memorizable spells and doubles it. That's it.
Yeah. I don't mind that. Yeah. I frankly don't mind that. I will say that your initial campaign rule is exactly the rule in original D&D as of the first supplement, for what it's worth. And There's text in first edition that copies that forward. Actually, that's a very classic way of doing it. Actually.
Yep. So that's what I use, and like I said, it generated some interesting stuff, right? Like there's Caddy the Water Wizard is one of my pre-gen characters who's an elf fighter magic user, and one of the interesting things about that character is that somehow, and I can't remember at this point. I think it's unlikely that the random generation did it perfectly, and so I probably went back and hand edited stuff a little bit, but. Gave that character the epithet the Water Wizard, and then proceeded to give them a Helm of Underwater Action, and then the spell selection. I was like, oh, right. So I think the spell selection now is very much geared towards like it's water, right? So no fire spells. Caddy does not have Fireball, and he has Lightning Bolt, or you know, other you know anything water related I could get in there, which I love. I just love
you know,
that.
I feel
the name actually is evocative of the character.
So I feel that that's another example of, see, I see those, you know, themed wizards, right? You know, different editions of D&D have, you know, brought in mechanics to try to make that happen. I don't feel I've ever been really super happy with how that worked. Yeah. I frequently wish that I had mechanics that promoted themed wizards, and it seems like it's going to be a lot of machinery to encourage that, but it's another place where with the pre-gens you can just make it happen. You want themed wizards, here's your themed wizards, and we can make it happen, again cheating a little bit without having to invent rules to get them there. So that I also do the same thing, and I think it's another nice opportunity to kind of shape the feel of the game like that.
I think you and I actually did the same thing here when we were running the A series of modules, which comes with pre-generated characters, but we both adapted them to classic D&D. And of course, there's a character in that called Fanstern the Illusionist, who is an illusionist, which does not exist in any of the editions of games that we're playing. And so we both did exactly the same thing, which is customize the magic items and spells to make them an illusionist. Just that it's a magic user who happens to have a lot of illusion stuff.
Great. It's perfect. That's all you need. Perfect. I totally agree.
Yeah. Yeah.
Paul, can I go into wrap? I have a list that I just updated, right? Within the week, frankly. So I'm so glad you suggested this. So I have here's my rapid fire list of things that I do. So when I'm making my pre-gens, I use my OED tool. I generate some basic stuff, and then I go in and I have the manual stuff that I have to adjust. And so among the things that I am careful to adjust here is, one, I avoid any chaotic or evil alignments, okay? So if any of the characters came out chaotic for our games, which basically means evil, I switch it to something else. I avoid that as part of the games. I do fill in all the languages, and you and I were talking about that recently. So I think for original D&D, you can get pretty good, the characters have an enormous number of languages that they may know based on their intelligence. Mm-hmm. I pre-fill all that in, again, to avoid conversations about it. And when you do that, you have pretty good coverage. You're going to cover the majority of the monsters that are in original D&D. And then you're going to have some character that pops up kind of unexpectedly that they're the one that speak a particular language, which I don't mind. So I actually fill in all that stuff. No duplicates. No duplicate languages, because I want as much coverage as possible. I try, and our friend Julian had a comment here a couple minutes ago of providing the descriptions to all the spells that the specific character has on the sheet. And I certainly don't have enough space for that, but I try, space permitting, to put explanations of what does this unusual feat do? What are the abilities of an elf or a dwarf? And then some of us who are playing say, you should point out the fact that fighters get sweep attacks if they're fighting orcs and they're fourth level, they get four attacks per round. I just added that to some of my sheets. So putting in those kinds of descriptions for unusual things is smart. I do try to add some mundane gear, like ropes and packs and sacks, lights. I'm not trying to cover everything, but at least gets players thinking about this might be an issue and maybe they want to add some more stuff. And then I am now fixing the spells to exactly what they've got memorized. And again, I try to tune that to the character. So my elven fighter wizard is going to have kind of more fighty stuff, more combat-y stuff, and my elven fighter thief is going to have more sneaky stuff. And those are some of the things that I'm trying to fill out these days to get the play started as soon as possible.
Yeah. I mean, like, I don't fill out a lot of, I give them a random smattering of extra equipment. I generally always give my players the opportunity to say, like, okay, any other extra normal equipment you want, we can go down that road and whatnot. And I'm also often willing to hand wave and just say, like, yeah, of course you brought whatever this thing, depending on the needs of the adventure. But part of that is because I want to have this stable of characters and I don't want them to be crafted to the adventure. I'm surprised by your no duplicate languages. Like, doesn't that remove the fun moment of you and I are going to have a secret conversation by speaking the language that only the two of us know?
We've had that's interesting. We've had fun with that. I feel like that's one of those, like, secret. Again, I don't try to do too much secrets between the players kind of stuff. And my next thing is, like, how do we actually play that out? Are we talking at the table and pretending we don't know, or are the two players going someplace else, which... And not super fond of that kind of stuff.
I feel like it usually comes up for me when the two players want to have a conversation with each other in front of an NPC. You know, like, let's talk about how we want to approach this without cluing the NPC into what's happening. We're talking in Elvish, and I'm going to put my hand on my head to indicate I'm speaking Elvish or whatever it is.
That's an interesting point. I think my priority at the moment is to get as much coverage that if a particular monster needs talking to, probably someone can do it, maybe.
Yeah. Dan, we are out of time.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, of course. Very interesting conversation. Do you have any final thoughts on pre-gen characters?
Whenever I think about this, Paul, our good late friend BJ made great games with great pre-generated characters. And he told me at one point, he said the biggest, the most time-consuming part of making these games is the pre-gen characters. And when I first heard that, I was like, ridiculous. Ridiculous, BJ. The content and the places and the things and the monsters and the treasures and all, so much, the maps, like there's so much other stuff that go in the game that can't possibly be the case. And over the years, I've been like, yeah, BJ's right. somewhat to my surprise. And it kind of makes sense in that it's the most, when you give the character sheets out, it's the most prominent player-facing thing. And having that kind of refined and make sense and not have errors on it and introduce the players of the game is really hugely important. Most of the other stuff that we have behind the screen, we can improvise. We can adjust on the fly. We can kind of justify things on the fly. But as something you actually hand to the player to get started with, it is good to get that right. It can take a lot of time. You want to pre-plan what your process is, like we're talking about here today, so it doesn't take too much time because you can kind of fall down a rabbit hole there. Look for good tools. Paul and I have, put a lot of time and thought, other people have as well, into our character generator tools for classic D&D. So I think that's a great starting point. Making as many decisions up front as possible, giving hopefully maybe a curtain summary to players is smart. And then once they have that sheet, the players can then take, the rule book and dig into the details as play progresses. And I think that's a really great way to get started in those kind of games, really kind of get the exciting stuff, the fun stuff happening as soon as possible. So I do think having a plan, having good tools to get started with is a great way to start. And it's a surprisingly hugely important part to your one shot games.
I agree with that. The effort that it takes to create the pre-gens, I think, is the reason why I enjoy now just having a pre-existing set of 12 that I just always bring for my D&D games, and plus the fact that it gives me practice as a DM of dealing with these players or these characters, the equipment they have, the spells they have, etc., which normally what I've would be something I would have in a campaign. Again, like with my one-off or one-shot D&D games, I want them to feel like a tiny slice of a campaign game. And so it helps that I'm like, I'm very familiar with your characters, right? Because I've played with them a lot. You just haven't gotten the chance to. On the other hand, like making the Fearful End characters that I'm working on right now, one of the fascinating things I'm noticing is I don't want to just run the same couple of scenarios that I've written over and over and over again at every con. I need to mix up what I'm doing. And I thought, oh, an easy way to speed myself up will be to get some pre-made Call of Cthulhu scenarios that I like and just adapt them. And that does speed things up. But then I got to the point of making the characters. And the funny thing is I was actually reading one scenario and I was like, I don't know if there's enough here to fill 4 hours. And then I started coming up with ideas for the characters and I went, oh, there's the other half of the game. There's the other half of the game is having these characters bounce off each other. Okay. Yeah, and I do feel like, and ultimately what I've done is I may have accelerated the scenario prep by using a pre-written thing, but I am still inventing quite a bit. And this, you know, yeah. So generating those characters for that scenario are basically half the work, I guess.
Great observations. Those are great observations, Paul. I'm glad we chatted about this today.
Me too. Viewers, if you have opinions on how to generate good pre-gen characters, know some good tools you want to drop, or have some thoughts about how to do things differently, please leave your thoughts in the comments section of the YouTube video here. We'd love to hear from you, and maybe that will spin off a new conversation for a future episode of Wandering DMs.
We would love that. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, GitHub, places like that. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all of the sites. So please, abridge that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can find those files on our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find us on various podcast carriers like iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Pocket Cast. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those sites, and it gives the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, huge thanks to our wonderful patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And just like Paul said at the top of the show, every tier gets you access to our private Discord server where the conversation 24/7 around the clock about classic D&D, horror games, miniatures, sci-fi games, all kinds of stuff. We just have the smartest, best, most tasteful patrons in all the land. And if you do have questions, I'm sure you'll get a lot of great suggestions if you ask on our Discord server. We will be there in about 10 minutes to continue today's conversation with a live video after chat with our patrons there. So please, if you haven't done that before, we would love for you to join us here in our Sunday afternoon conversations. And of course, don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please, we hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.